The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Professor John Unterrecker teaches English at the University of Hawaii. He was educated at Middlebury College and at Columbia University, and he has taught at Flinders University in Australia and at the University of Texas. Professor Unterrecker is the author of two books of poetry, and he's written a biography of the American writer Hart Crane, a book entitled Voyager, which was nominated for the National Book Award in 1970. He is also the author of A Reader's Guide to William Butler Yeats. Professor Unterrecker visited the National Humanities Center recently, where he discussed biography and autobiography for Soundings, the center's radio program. Joining in the conversation is Professor James Olney of North Carolina Central University in Durham. Professor Olney, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, is an authority on biography and autobiography. He's the author of numerous articles and books, including Metaphors of Self, The Meaning of Autobiography, and work on the poet William Butler Yeats and the psychologist Carl Jung. Professor Unterrecker, why do people write biographies and autobiographies?
Well, I suppose the answer is to present, if not the truth, the illusion of truth. And I think they often write autobiographies in an effort to provide a rationale for their lives, sometimes a whitewash. As far as biographies are concerned, I think the same things hold. Only sometimes, instead of a whitewash, the object is exposé. In other words, I think that there are very few pure autobiographies and very few pure biographies.
Couldn't you say that a lot of biographies get started in the pursuit of truth with a capital T? And where do they go awry? What's the problem?
Well, it isn't so much that they go awry, but everyone has his own version of the truth, not least the biographer himself, so that he becomes an element in the biography that simply can't be eliminated, even if he wants to eliminate it. He's got his own prejudices, his own history, his own childhood to cope with, and he sees himself, to some extent at least, reflected in his subject. And as that reflection makes him nervous, he tends either to overweigh his own obsessions or to steer clear of them. He tends, in other words, to clean up in his subject things that he doesn't want to get investigated in his own biography. At least that's my guess.
Could I pick up on something you said in your first remarks, that the biographer has one intention and the autobiographer another? I think that's profoundly true, and that autobiography, at least as I see it, is a very different act from biography. That the biographer sets out with some intention of perhaps discovering truth or creating an illusion of truth, whatever, but the autobiographer is thinking of very different things, I think. There are other kinds of autobiography from the kind that is as Jack called it, is a whitewash. I think there are autobiographers who are whom one would call more profoundly serious than that, who are seeking through their life to discover some kind of patterns and therefore some kind of meaning for their experience. They come to a certain point in their life when perhaps it seems to have been all futile, and they want to look back and see if there is some way that they can discover something in their experience that makes it something other than futile. But for me, anyway, biography and autobiography are profoundly different acts. And the conventional wisdom says that autobiography is a particular kind of of biography, but I think implicit in what you were just saying, the biographer is himself performing a kind of act of autobiography.
Oh, there's no question of it. In fact, his act of autobiography is, I think, conspicuous mm-hmm. in every biography. Well, let me simply take an immediate example of Léon Adel's work on Henry James. Adel insisting that the act of the biographer is the discovery of some kind of a psychological truth about his subject. If you don't assume that the biographer has special insight into psychological truth that he's discovered in his own life, then he simply is incapable of writing such a biography. Mm-hmm. So that in a sense, Adele's biography of Henry James is a conversation between Adele and a projected Henry James.
Yes, yes. And there's a further complication or subtlety involved in that kind of relationship between the author of a biography, the subject of the biography, and the pattern that the biographer discerns in the life of the subject of the biography. Specifically in the case of Adele's biography of Henry James, it seems to me that there's a kind of a Freudian pattern discovered mm-hmm. by Adele. And the interesting thing is there are a number of biographers, good biographers, like Adele, who operate from Freudian premises and discover certain Freudian patterns in the life of their subject. But the what to me is a profoundly interesting thing is that the father of the great one who perceived all these Freudian patterns in the beginning, Freud himself, he was capable of writing biographies, as of Leonardo da Vinci, the essay on da Vinci, in which he discovers perfectly Freudian patterns. But when Freud comes to write his own autobiographical study, he doesn't discover them for himself.
Precisely. And in fact, one of the real problems, I think, for the biographer is dealing with a subject who has himself written an autobiography. Mm. In almost every instance that I can think of, the biographer working with a subject who has written his own autobiography is devoting a great deal of his time and energy to commenting on the distortions yes. That are in that autobiography. Certainly the commentaries on Freud's autobiography
yes.
are almost all focused on the kind of thing that you're talking about, that he blinds himself quite deliberately to any psychological interpretation of his own experiences.
Yes. Or conversely, sometimes the biographer is hamstrung by the presence of an autobiography and follows it through as if an autobiography actually contained a clear exposition of historical fact, which it almost never does.
Yes.
Professor Unterecker, how would you characterize successful autobiography or biography?
Well, I think successful autobiography usually does come to that kind of self-discovery that may be false. That is, it's self-discovery for the autobiographer, perhaps false to the true facts of his life, in which he thinks at least he's found some meaningful pattern in his life. Now, I don't know if such autobiographers always in fact have found it. That is, I think that they construct a convenient fiction out of factual materials, and that autobiography, in a real sense, isn't very far from what we now hear of as biographical fiction, for example. The autobiographer has so much that he has to keep dark. Even if he's writing a purely confessional autobiography, the sort of thing Frank Harris tried, in which he was giving a history of his sexual career, even then, because he's focused on that aspect of his life, he blots out almost everything else. He acts as if he never edited a book in that autobiography.
Yes, yes.
And he was a great editor.
A lot of people are interested in genealogy and writing family histories, and they become interested in writing about themselves. Where is the line between simply jotting down the sequence of events? I was born, I was reared, I went to school. Where is the line between that kind of thing and what you term finding a pattern in one's life?
Well, it's a very fine line. I don't know whether one can actually discover a line, but what Jack was just saying about the fictionalizing of experience when you select and choose and even focusing on one particular motif or whatever, that means that you leave everything else out. But even prior to that, there is a fiction that enters in when you begin with the word I. because you're positing a continuity of consciousness, a continuity of existence between the past and the present, which, when it's put into language, is absolutely unjustifiable.
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, there's an I.
But as far as I'm concerned, there is also.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, that I that the autobiographer uses is a very small part of the possible I's of his life. That is, it seems to me that almost every person is, in a sense, a compound personality, and that various aspects of his personality show up as he deals with various people. And I often talk about the relationship between a man and his parents, the relationship between a man and his wife or a lover or children, perhaps students if he teaches. Each of these see a totally different kind of personality in him. And that totally different personality is valid for each of those persons. That is the true person as far as the outsider looking at him is concerned. But what he sees as the true person is an odd, peculiar thing that no one else sees, and that almost every outsider sees as a kind of fiction. That's why I think autobiography is both incredibly revealing, because it reveals to us a different personality from the man that we know, mm-hmm. and also incredibly astonishing to his intimates, who say, well, he's deceived us all these years.
Yes, and two, there's the phenomenon, I think, that we always see other people much more clearly than we see ourselves. Mm-hmm. We may see them in a completely inaccurate light, but we assume that other people have a kind of coherence and unity about them that I don't think that we ordinarily feel about ourselves. It's as if looking inward, everything is very dark. Looking outward, everything is very, very clear and sharp and distinct.
You know, the very great poet, William Butler Yeats, Irish poet, did not an autobiography, but what he called autobiographies. And he really picked up on this kind of an idea. He took aspects of his life and wrote about each of those aspects, small essays. So he took childhood and adolescence as a kind of special discovery area. He was looking at childhood and adolescence to find what he could find in his own childhood and adolescence that drove him into poetry. Mm-hmm. And I think later on, when he broke up his life into segments, love affairs became one unit, political friends one unit. Mm-hmm. His career as a politician, one unit. And each of those seemed to him separate aspects of his personality, so separate that he was indeed, for all practical purposes, a different person in each of those contexts.
And he had to have a separate section for the occult experiences, too.
And he had to have a separate section for his mystical and occult experiences.
So the idea of sequence really becomes secondary in the recitation of one's life.
For Yeats, sequence didn't mean much. Though he followed a very loosely sequential system with great gaps.
Professor Underecker, I've heard you mention the intersections of facts, truths, and characters in terms of biography, poetry, and fiction. Those tend really to blur together. What do you have in mind?
Well, all right, let me put it this way. It seems to me, first of all, that there's a vast difference between the way the 19th century apprehended the world and the way the 20th century apprehended the world. The 19th century thought that given the opportunity, everything could be predicted. If we could only know enough about the past, we could predict with absolute precision the future. It seems to me the whole of contemporary physics has thrown that idea into a cocked hat. That the whole notion of modern physics, at least, is a notion of probability theory. And I think that that's sloughed off onto the literary community as well. I think, for instance, that if we're to talk about biography, the assembly of facts in a biography presents what seems to me the illusion of reality. Not reality itself, but the illusion that those facts assembled are something real. I think that fiction, on the other hand, gives us the illusion of life itself.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Professor John Unterrecker of the University of Hawaii was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, where he discussed his work on the writing of biography and autobiography for Soundings. Professor Unterrecker was educated at Middlebury College and at Columbia University. He's published numerous books and articles. Professor Unterrecker is best known for two works, his biography of Hart Crane, entitled Voyager, which was nominated for the National Book Award in 1970, and A Reader's Guide to William Butler Yeats, first published in 1959. Joining in the conversation is Professor James Olney of North Carolina Central University in Durham. Professor Olney, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, is an authority on biography and autobiography. He's the author of Metaphors of Self, The Meaning of Autobiography, and he has edited a collection entitled Autobiography, Essays, Theoretical and Critical. As the conversation resumes now, Professor Unterrecker is discussing the connections between poetry, fiction, and biography and autobiography.
A kind of a statement. When Keats says, beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know, he's combining two strange abstractions in a strange way. Truth and beauty. And somehow they equate. Now we know perfectly well they don't equate. But they seem to. And we're teased by that thought into thinking there's a great and a profound insight. Beauty is truth. It's really a metaphor he's constructing, because he's saying beauty is like truth, and truth is like beauty. And these create excitement in our minds, and we say, ah, here's a profound generalization. And I think that poetry is constantly giving us these kinds of profound generalizations out of its rather peculiar structures.
It occurred to me when you were talking about what the novel attempted to do in the 19th century as against what it attempts to do or conceives as possible in the 20th century, that the 19th century gave us the slice of life novel, didn't it?
Sure.
With the sense that they could slice off a piece of life and present it in a novel. And now the novelist is reduced to attempting, at least, the illusion of felt life. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, with autobiography, that the premises of autobiography in the 19th century, the conditions, let us say, under which somebody would write an autobiography in the 19th century were profoundly different from the conditions under which someone could write an autobiography in our century. And I think, by way of two works that are neatly contrasting, I think, Darwin's autobiography in the 19th century and Lauren Isley's autobiography, mm-hmm. Isley, the anthropologist, archaeologist. And towards the end of his, to take Darwin's first of all, one has the feeling that Darwin is saying that if he could gather together all the facts of his life, he could account for exactly what he had become and what he had done, what he was. It's very different when one comes to Isley, who towards the end of his autobiography, All the Strange Hours, says, I am an evolutionist. I do believe in this kind of determinism that's led down to me. But, he says, I cannot, in spite of the fact that I'm an evolutionist, I cannot account for life coming together out of the elements in the way that it does, into all the human passions and emotions that we all experience. And he says, I cannot even account for myself. Darwin assumes that he could account for himself if he had all the facts there. Isley assumes that there's some kind of mystery, some kind of probability, as you say, but not a certainty that remains in the end totally unaccountable.
I think also all of this hinges on a very old controversy, determinism versus free will. And I think that the contemporary science, oddly enough, as opposed certainly to almost everything in 19th century science and 19th century thought, is saying that that strange quality of free will is in almost everything. There are floppy molecules that don't behave properly. There are erratic behaviors of electrons in subnuclear physics that aren't expected to make good sense. That is, that there's always an unpredictable element in life, and that if we extend this, that unpredictable element is the quality of free will in all things. Mm-hmm. Just not much of it, but a little leading edge of it. If everything in our past shapes us to be something else, and I just want to change your metaphor just a little bit. The past, in Darwin's terms, shaped him, and if he knew his total past, yes, he could define his total being.
Yes.
But I think one of the things that the 19th century forgot is that one of the things that the past shapes is the independent mind of the shaped thing.
Sure.
That is, it shapes freedom. Mm-hmm. And with that independent mind, the free agent of the person acts on all those shaping forces of his past. And suddenly he becomes a manipulator as well as something manipulated by the whole force of history. So in a little way, he's shaping his future. And in that small moment of being that we ride on, like on the front crest of a wave, we can't do anything next week because we haven't got there, and we can't do anything yesterday because it's finished. Mm-hmm. But in that little now of the present that's always skidding along with us, we have an action not so much to do independent things as to not do things. And in the choice not to do, we have wonderful freedom. Mm-hmm.
Professor Unterecker and Professor Olney, I wonder if you would comment on the use of psychology in biography and autobiography.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see anything wrong with using anything in biography. I think that psychology has given us a lot of useful tools to talk about the way minds work. On the other hand, I think that traditional psychology has been somewhat simplistic. And that current psychology is searching very hard for ways not to be quite so simplistic as philosophy had been, say, 20 or 30 years ago. One of the most embarrassing things for a literary critic to do is to look over psychological interpretations of poems, in which poems become documents, not works of art, or for that matter, paintings or pieces of music or anything. The danger, I think, with the psychological interpretation of biography is that it oversimplifies the complexity of human life, and sometimes, unless he's an extraordinarily astute man, the person using it uses it in a heavy-handed way, and you really do feel as if you're in the presence of someone trimming his nails with a meat axe.
Can I go just a little bit further back in the discussion of psychology and its relationship to the writing of autobiography or biography? People have been psychologists forever. I mean, we're all psychologists. Whether we subscribe to a school of psychology or not, that's another thing. But St. Augustine is a profound psychologist, one of the profoundest psychologists who ever lived, ever wrote. And psychology, after all, is just the science of the mind, or psyche, or soul, or however one translates the Greek psyche. But everybody's been a psychologist, and I don't see how it's possible to attempt to write a biography or an autobiography without exercising the role of a psychologist. And then it depends precisely, as Jack says, on how subtle a psychologist, how comprehensive a psychologist the biographer is. And if he is crude, if he brings a rigid scheme to impose on the life of the subject, then it's going to be very, very bad indeed. And it doesn't matter whether the psychology that is being employed is Freudian or Jungian or Adlerian or whatever it is. If it's badly done, if it's done in a heavy-handed way, if it's a meat cleaver, to trim the nails, then it's going to result in a distortion, and a profound distortion of the life that is supposed to provide the center of this.
The book. Subject will have mashed fingers. Along the same line, however, it seems to me that it is interesting that 20th century biography, because we're a much more open society than the 19th century ever could have been. Granted, the 19th century world, even 19th century publication practices, we have looked much more into the sexual roots of personality than anything really that was done in the 19th century. And I think that really has been a significant change in biography, and as well in autobiography. Although autobiographers still treat their own sexual lives with a great deal, yes, of nervous discretion. Here again, biographers get into terrible bad spots because they simply don't know enough. One of the real problems with biography always is that you're going to have huge areas of ignorance where you just don't have any documents, no letters, no confessional reports, no anything, and then maybe a dozen letters that are immensely intimate. Well, suddenly you get one intimate slice of a man's life, and the temptation is great to say, aha, here's the secret code to his soul. What we have to remember is that there are all those unspoken desires, the dreams that we simply can't intrude in, that he didn't record, and in fact, he didn't remember. So as we set up being amateur psychologists and probing the sexual roots of his activity, I think we have to realize that the confusion of his life is as great as the confusion of our own lives, and that those are delicate areas that we ourselves, trying to write autobiography, if we do try to write, will not censor out for reasons of censorship, sometimes simply because we don't want to hurt other people. So we'll block out whole aspects of our lives if we're writing autobiography. Or as I said with Frank Harris, we'll act as if there were no other aspect of our lives at all and distort.
Could that be the difference between what Professor Unterecker was talking about, determinism and free will?
We
afford ourselves the luxury of free will. And
don't like to see ourselves as determined in quite the same way. Yes. Well, I was going to poke in Hart Crane's grandmother's love letters as an example of a poet coping with biographical commentary, and simply demonstrating in a poem many of the things that we've been saying, that the biographer's project is one of enormous delicacy, and that finally, I think what every biographer, and I certainly as a biographer of Hart Crane, came to feel was that what I was demonstrating was the impossibility of biography, finally. I was offering a life of Hart Crane, and I was very careful not to allow the title to become the life of Hart Crane. It was a life, but Crane himself gave me all the cues I needed in a wonderful little poem called My Grandmother's Love Letters, and I wondered if I could use that. Here's his poem. Because it deals with the materials of biography, memory and letters. That's what a biographer works with. There are no stars tonight but those of memory. Yet how much room for memory there is in the loose girdle of soft rain. There's even room enough for the letters of my mother's mother, Elizabeth, that have been pressed so long into a corner of the roof that they are brown and soft and liable to melt as snow. Over the greatness of such space, steps must be gentle. It is all hung by an invisible white hair. It trembles as birch limbs webbing the air. And I ask myself, are your fingers long enough to play old keys that are but echoes? Is the silence strong enough to carry back the music to its source and back to you again, as though to her? Yet I would lead my grandmother by the hand through much of what she would not understand. And so I stumble, and the rain continues on the roof with such a sound of gently pitying laughter. I think that really says a lot of what we've been saying, that the problem of the biographer is tact and ignorance, and that there is often no way ever to get back to the true reality of any past life or even any past event.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation, in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Please join us for the Center's radio program, Soundings. This week, we feature a conversation with two prominent authorities on biography, autobiography, and American letters, Professor James Olney and Professor John Unterecker. I hope you'll listen for Soundings.